Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone. My name is Kieran Tavam, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend out in the United States, JJ Duke. JJ, how are you, mate?
Kieran, I'm good.
Yeah, good at the moment, but difficult one this episode. Difficult to the point where we're actually splitting the episode in two this week. This is obviously episode 54, but we're going to have to call this one episode 54.1. We're going to release an episode 54.2 because there has been a lot going on in women's football since we did our last show. And JJ, we have to obviously start with the situation that's going on over here in England with Mark Sampson and the English FA. Of course, last week it was confirmed that Mark Sampson had been relieved of his duties after what would appear a report came into the hands of the FA relating to safeguarding issues. And for anyone who's listening, I know that a few people in the United States asked me about what safeguarding was. Safeguarding essentially means it's a bit like protecting people's health, well-being, human rights, and enabling them to live free from harm and a few other things. That's actually come from one of the charities over here. I wanted to make sure I got it right so that I don't mislead people. But I'll read out the statement that the FA released when they announced that Mark Sampson was no longer the England coach. It read, "The Football Association can confirm that Mark Sampson's contract as England women's head coach has been terminated with immediate effect. Prior to taking charge of the national team in December 2013, Mark was manager of Bristol Academy. In 2014, safeguarding allegations were made against him about his time with Bristol. The safeguarding assessment was that he did not pose a risk working in the game. However, the full report of that investigation was only brought to the attention of the current FA leadership last week, and it is our judgment that it revealed clear evidence of inappropriate and unacceptable behaviour by a coach. It is on this basis that we have acted quickly to agree a termination of Mark's contract. In respect of investigations into specific allegations made by Eniola Aluko in 2016, the FA stands by the findings of the independent barrister Catherine Newton's investigation. Mark Sampson has denied all the accusations put to him and no evidence of wrongdoing was found. We will continue to support the independent investigation as it reviews the recent evidence presented to it and publish any new findings and recommendations." So, of course, we have to remind people that before this statement came out, Mark Sampson was, of course, the subject of some allegations made by Chelsea striker Eniola Aluko. Of course, she's got over 100 caps for England. We spoke about it on the last show regarding those allegations that Mark Sampson had made comments that could be perceived as racist. Two independent investigations have found that there was no wrongdoing. But since that report and since those allegations have come out, her teammate Drew Spence, who in the last show we didn't name because I know that there is a request by the player to remain anonymous, she has since come forward and confirmed some allegations that Eniola Aluko had put to the FA, that there were some inappropriate comments made by Mark Sampson towards Drew during a tour of China in 2015. Now, JJ, I've spoken a lot, and obviously I find this quite difficult to talk about. Obviously, the reputation of women's football in England is not great at the moment with all of this, but I'll kind of carry on, but I don't want to keep talking. I'm kind of interested to know what the perception is of what's going on over here from an outsider looking in. I'm kind of interested to know what you guys have made of it over there.
Well, at least, you know, to speak for my, like, on my behalf, you know, it's one of those things that this is really challenging and disappointing because, you know, we're talking about it, and unfortunately this is going to be a theme of both of these episodes that we have, or both of the parts of this episode coming out, is a lot of shocking themes, disappointing themes. And, you know, we thought for the last few months we had this major international tournament with the Euros, and, you know, a lot of things looked really positive. You know, there's a lot of good things that we were talking about, growth within some nations that really we didn't see it a whole lot before, and the improvement of women's football and the competitiveness. And then all of a sudden, especially with England, you know, over what, the past couple of years, a great showing at the World Cup, you know, getting to the semifinals of the European Championships, you figure, all right, so now this program is going to be right on the rise. And then all of a sudden we see all this come about. I think the big one for me, Kieran, and you and I were talking about this before we were recording, it's just the the lack of transparency and the lack of being efficient about all of this. I mean, if we're understanding that this report was made back in 2014, why was this not part of the, you know, the initial interview session with Mark Sampson? I mean, you'd have to assume, and this almost goes for any job that anybody interviews for, that you're going to have a background check. How was this not involved with the background check? So, you know, now it's 3 years later on, we're finding about this now, and then all of a sudden, you know, one allegation comes, then another comes, and it becomes this domino effect, which is why I think this is so disappointing, really, in how the way that it was handled at the beginning, and now how it's really just become, in my opinion, damage control by the F at the moment, because they're trying to, I don't even know if it's to save face at this point, but it's really just trying to cover anything that could have been left open. And now England at the moment, I mean, sure, they played a very good match against Russia in the, you know, World Cup qualifying, but yeah, that might have almost seemed at that time the last thing that people were thinking about was the actual game. So I think that's kind of what, how I've been seeing things over the past week. And yeah, I'm with you again. This is tough. There's no easy way to go about this because we can't speculate. We can only go by what's being said officially. Of course, there's going to be always many opinions and out there and the what could have beens, but it's a challenging time for women's soccer right now.
Yeah, really difficult. And I think, you know, it's difficult because, you know, we're very invested in the women's game, and it's not like, I'm not in any way, you know, criticizing mainstream media. It's because of mainstream media that really this has all come about. You know, you have to give huge credit and admire Ennio Luco for coming out and speaking so openly about the position that she's in and the feelings that she had and the allegations that have been made. And you have to give credit to Drew Spence for coming forward last week or whenever it was, a few days ago. You know, these are people who are putting themselves in very difficult positions. And, you know, as a result of that, I think it was always going to be that danger, mate, that there would be more that would come out eventually. And I genuinely don't think this is the end of it. I think there's probably going to be more revelations that we hear. What they are, I don't know. We can only talk about the things that are out there. I think one of the other things that's concerning is that there's an organization over here called Women in Football. They released a statement after this all came out, and they said Women in Football understand the questions over Sampson's suitability for the role were flagged to the FA as early as 2013 during the recruitment process. So we're talking about before he'd even got the job, you know, when Hope Powell was relieved of her duties after Euro 2013. It would appear that there were question marks over Mark Sampson's suitability even before he'd got the job. And you have to ask why, if there were question marks over his suitability, were the FA still in a position where they felt they could employ him when they had, you know, they had the pickings? You know, we're talking about a nation, granted, I'll give him credit, you know, he has moved England on two semi-finals of the two last major tournaments England have competed in. But there was a real group of head coaches that were really keen on that England role. You know, I know that, you know, people like Paul Riley were interested in the job, Tony DiCicco was spoken to, John Herdman was linked with the role. England were not short of options for that role, and yet they went with Mark Sampson despite the question marks over his suitability. And now we're talking 3.5-4 years later, all this stuff has come out and it looks and sounds terrible. And I don't know how the FA and I don't know how English football at the moment kind of recovers from this.
It's going to take a long time, I would have to presume, because as you said, I think you're right, this could very well be the first of many skeletons to come out of the closet. I mean, you know, we talked about on previous episode about, you know, it was an unidentified player that turns out to be Drew Spence. So there could be more that we could find out. Who knows? I mean, you know, that's one of the things right now. You not only have to think about, you know, the group of players, you know, that were heavily influenced by this, but how about the rest of, you know, the players that are currently in the senior camp? How about the youth national team players that might have had an opportunity to speak with Mark Sampson about potentially maybe even getting a look down the road for a senior team? And then all of a sudden, all this happens. And you don't even think so much about just the players as footballers. You think about just the well-being of the individual. I mean, this is going to take a toll emotionally for a while. And I think, you know, for a lot of people might not even really fully understand. I don't think we're ever going to fully understand it because we're never going to be in those shoes. So, it's tough. And I think also we talked about this before, and I think it's a point. We don't like to talk about this stuff because in addition to what we do as journalists and, you know, trying to promote the well-being of this sport, we're fans. We want to see positive things happening in the sport and continue to see the growth. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of the thing that it makes it difficult for us to talk about, because we want progress. You know, we want good things to come of it. Sure, there's always going to be negative things, and we're not fanning away from it, but we want to try and promote everything that's happening in good within the game. And, you know, it seems that right now this is just a really trialing time for everybody. And my kind of hope is, you know, there's no end win for anybody here, but everything I hope can kind of get smoothed out as quickly as possible, get all the information out, because now clearly it's got to be on the FA to be as transparent as possible about everything. So let's hope that they do it. Let's hope that the process gets done, and, you know, for all the players that are there, they find the right coach that's going to be best suited for the role, and, you know, they try and continue to elevate the program to new heights.
Yeah, and I think that's the important thing you mentioned there is transparency. I put a tweet out saying how bad this situation was and that nobody wins, and Anita Asante was absolutely right to kind of respond to that. You know, she said, this isn't about winning, this is about transparency. You know, this has really exposed some flaws in how this has all been handled, about the appointment of Mark Sampson in the first place. And if people like Enny and Leanne Sanderson and Anita Asante and Drew Spence hadn't spoken about this, then we might be in a situation where this, well, we probably would be in a situation where this hadn't been exposed. So you have to give those players, you know, huge credit for being brave enough to come out. You know, what it means for them long term, I really don't know. You know, I'm sure that they're not thinking about that at the moment. You know, Enny made her first appearance for Chelsea at the weekend. Obviously, the WSL kicked off this weekend. We'll talk about that shortly. And she got a really positive response from Chelsea fans. You look at social media, Chelsea club and fans are right behind her. There has been some social media, I think, you know, aimed at Enny, blaming her for Mark Sampson's departure. This is not on Enny. This is not on Enny. This is not on Leanne Sanderson. This is not on the players. This is on Mark Sampson. You know, Mark Sampson is in his position because of what the FA have read in this report. We can't speculate what has happened because we don't know. But this isn't on the players that have made the allegations. You know, the person who's responsible is the person who's lost their job. Now the difficulty is that there are now question marks over the handling of it. The chief executive, Martin Glenn, is obviously, you know, under the spotlight. The FA have come out on the day of recording saying that they're happy with the processes that were put in place, and they've backed Martin Glenn. So it's really, really difficult, mate. And as I said, you know, they now, I think it's on the 18th of October, it's been confirmed, the FA will have to face Parliament questions as well now over the handling of the situation. This is not going to go away. This is going to rumble on and on and on. And the other thing now is that, you know, England and the FA have to try and find someone who's going to replace Mark Sampson. And I am almost certain that they're going to take their time over this, because they now need to do their due diligence. They need to make sure the person they get in doesn't have any kind of, for want of a better term, skeletons in the closet. And that's going to take time. And it might be that we don't see an England manager for a few months.
Yeah, I think you're right on that one. And, you know, there, as you said before, prior to Sampson taking the job, there's a number of people that, you know, could very well have been qualified to take and could have done similar results. And, you know, with eyes on this process now, there are even more qualified coaches and good coaches at that could continue to build the program. But you're right. I would think it'd be a bold statement to say we don't see a new England manager before the end of the calendar year, but it's not going to be coming in the next 2 weeks. I would be shocked if it even comes, you know, before November.
No, yeah, I think you're right. Fair. I think you're right. I think they'll probably put maybe someone in the system, a Marianne Spacey or a Mo Marley in an interim position, Brent Hills possibly. And they will take their time. You know, England's next game is a friendly in October against France. They've got, I think, one or two World Cup qualifiers this side of Christmas. And then I think you're right. I don't think it's going to be until the new year that we see a new head coach appointed. They will want to do their due diligence. They will not want to leave any stone unturned. I can imagine they are going to be asking a lot of questions of a lot of people on the candidates that they see fit to potentially replace Mark Sampson. And it may well be that, you know, it could be an internal candidate already in the system, a Marianne Spacey or a Mo Marley, who does take it on an interim basis, who ends up doing well and taking the job on a permanent basis. But yeah, really difficult, mate. Really, really difficult. I know I've kept relatively quiet on social media relating to this and just kind of wanted to absorb everything. I think people like Daniel Taylor at The Guardian deserve a huge amount of credit. They have grabbed this story by the neck and really ran with it, and it's because of his work and a lot of, you know, a lot of others that we find ourselves in this position. And it has, as we've said, you know, exposed some issues. There are transparency issues that we hope will improve moving forward. And now the FA have some difficult questions to answer, and as I said, this isn't going to go away. They have you know, they've got some difficult few months coming up ahead of them. But looking at the candidates for the role, mate, I mean, there's lots of names that are being bandaged about. Emma Hayes ruled herself out this past weekend, saying that she's very happy at Chelsea with the setup and the support that she gets. I mean, I won't reel off names. I think, as we've said, there's no real point in doing that because we're not expecting an appointment, you know, anytime soon. But if you're the FA and you're looking at candidates, who's your number one choice?
It's a tough question, right? I think that's a million-dollar question at the moment. But, yeah, you know, what my understanding, and this is somebody that doesn't have a whole lot of access to what's going on within the system already and who is being in place. You know, a lot of these younger players that are coming in right now have had the experience, like you said, under Marianne Spacey and Mo Marley. And everything that I've actually heard about Mo Marley in specific has been nothing but positive. So if it's somebody that's internal, I might give the nod to her just because of, you know, things that I've understood. But yeah, I would almost rule out pretty much any club coach at a high, you know, high level club. You know, as you said with Emma Hayes, I don't think Nick Cushing goes. You know, I heard rumors about Laura Harvey. I think she's very happy at Seattle at the moment. Paul Riley, similar situation, as he said, very happy here in the United States, both at home in Long Island, as well as down with the North Carolina Courage. So, yeah, it's a tough one right now. Do you have anybody that you're thinking in mind?
Well, I mean, look, there are plenty of options out there. Again, you know, I would say that England are even more attractive now than they were when Mark Sampson took the job on. You know, Hope Powell left under a bit of a cloud with the poor performance at the Euros in 2013. No question, Hope did tremendous work with England and the FA and dragged the England national team, for want of a better term, out of the gutter. You know, they were not getting any support, they weren't getting financial backing, or certainly weren't getting very much. And she was able to implement a lot of good things. So that is not an indictment on Hope's tenure as England head coach. But you look at it 4 years on and England are ranked in the top three in the world. They have one of the biggest budgets in terms of investment in Europe, in terms of what's being invested into the national team. I think it's a very, very attractive job to have. And if I'm a head coach for a number of big clubs or possibly other national teams, you know, I'm looking at the England job and thinking, yeah, do you know what? I quite fancy that. Now, I think the English FA will go with an English coach. I don't think it will be an overseas coach. I think that's something that they dabbled with in the men's game with the likes of Sven-Göran Eriksson and Fabio Capello. I don't think it necessarily worked out that well. Being honest, mate, I'm doing everything I can to get Laura Harvey. You know, Laura is not just a great coach, but one of the things that Laura is very good at is that she is very good. She's a good player manager. You know, she manages the relationships with her players very well. You speak to the players that she's coached, they all have nothing but good things to say. she's managed and coached big personalities in her career, the likes of Megan Rapinoe, and obviously managed the situation with Hope Solo very well. If I'm the FA, I'm doing everything I can to get Laura Harvey. But like you say, Laura's clearly very happy in Seattle. But my view is that if England don't go and get Laura Harvey, then the likelihood is that somewhere down the line, the US women's national team may well do. So I think if you want to get Laura, you probably have to get her now. But I don't know. I think, you know, Nick Cushing's a great shout. You know, you have to give Nick a lot of credit for what he's done at Man City. He won, you know, a league, a cup and an FA Cup last year. And, you know, they're a very, very good side. And Emma Hayes, I really like Emma Hayes. But I think, as we've already said, Emma's ruled herself out. Not really sure she's the type of person the FA would go for. Not that she's a bad person at all, but Emma's strong-minded and she's a big personality. And I don't know if the FA want that. Yeah, it's a difficult one, but I think you're right. I think they're probably looking more at a Mo Marley, someone in the system, someone who's, again, very highly respected by players. You ask, you know, a Tony Duggan or an Alex Greenwood, who worked with Mo at Everton when she was coach there. They think the world of her. So that's what they need at the moment. They need someone to go in there, and they need to pick that dressing room up, because the other thing you have to think about, when England played Russia and they got that win in the opening World Cup qualifier, when Nikita Paris scored that first goal, players all ran over to Mark Sampson and celebrated with him. Now, we have no idea how much the players knew and didn't know before all of this came out, but obviously there's been a few fingers pointed at those players saying, how could they do that? That was really disrespectful. But, you know, they need someone to go in there and pick those players up and move them forward, and they need someone who can deal with the situation that's currently ongoing at the moment, because, as we said, you know, there's still the investigation to come over Eni, Aluko and Drew Spence. So this is a tough one, mate. Really, really difficult one, and it's hard to talk about, but the credit goes to the players who've spoken out, the ones who've put themselves in a really difficult position. But I respect them. You know, they've done the right thing for them, and the right thing for exposing some flaws and some issues. I think we should go to a break, mate. I think we've spoken for a good 20 minutes on this one. And the FAWSL kicked off this past weekend, so let's have a little chat about that.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSOZone.
So, JJ, WSL is back, and it's back in a new format, with it running from September through to May, autumn through to the spring. The season opened with a Merseyside derby between Liverpool and Everton. It was Liverpool who came out on top. Obviously, their WSL 1 experience paying off. Everton newly promoted after, of course, taking the place of Notts County Ladies. Some interesting results over the weekend, wasn't there? I know you had an opportunity to watch Sunderland against Reading. What did you make of that one?
Yeah, interesting. A little bit surprising there, to be honest with you, with Reading, with all the additions that they made to the program. I thought that would have been one that they were going, not to say comfortable, because in our last episode, you and I talked, and I know you pegged Sunderland as a team that would struggle this year, with everything that's happened to them pretty much over the last 18 months or so. But you have to give credit to them. They held firm. Reading were wasteful, to be quite honest with you, with their chances. I think that they should have really been clinical, especially in the second half, because they opened up a fair amount of chances. They hardly called Farrah Williams' name. Jade Moore was active, but again, didn't really have much. Lauren Bruton showed some moments there, but I think there's a lot more disconnect than I thought there was going to be. And you have to give Sunderland credit. They didn't have many chances. Early goal scored by Simona Corrin, I think, what, 5-6 minutes in or something along those lines. But, yeah, they took the chance. They got it. And it's a road result for them, too, which I know you said they're breaking the table down into three parts. That's a road result against that middle-tier team. So that might be one of those that could, you can't think too far ahead about, could that be enough for them to stay up? Because if they can try and get the results against the teams that are in their tier, but that's going to give them a whole lot of confidence going forward in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, good start for Sunderland. And you're absolutely right. Thanks for calling me up on that one about Sunderland struggling as they get their opening win. Yeah, fair play to them. I'm going to fess up. I didn't get to see a lot of the FAWSL opening weekend because I was at a wedding. So all I have seen is really the goal highlights and a few other bits and pieces. But massive credit to Sunderland. You know, they've started really well. And as you say, against a team that I tipped, and still do, to be fair, to finish in that middle tier. They've made some shrewd signings. Obviously not a great start for Reading, but I think they'll pick up a few results here and there. But yeah, I mean, look, Sunderland have had a bit of an overhaul of the squad. We spoke to Rachel Laws for our WSL previews, and if anyone has missed those, you can see on womenssoccerzone.com. We've spoken to a representative of all 10 WSL 1 clubs, and Rachel Laws, the Sunderland goalkeeper who's returned after a brief stint with Durham, she said, you know, look, we know people are writing us off, but there's a lot of heart and a lot of determination at this club, and you know, I think we'll surprise a few people and prove a few people wrong. And they've started off very, very well. You know, they had a decent spring series. They finished fifth. You know, they finished middle of the table. And despite that, people like myself are still writing them off. So I give them huge credit for the win that they got at the weekend. You know, looking at the teams above them, you would expect the teams that get the most coverage and the most exposure and the most chat to start well, and they did. Chelsea put six past Bristol City. Man City won 4-0 at Yeovil. Arsenal with a slightly more tricky encounter. They were 2-1 down to Birmingham City with, like, what, 5-10 minutes left, and managed to turn that one around. I saw the goals for Chelsea, mate. They looked scintillating, and I think the pre-season predictions that they are actually going to be the team to beat, despite the fact that Man City won all of the domestic competitions last year, minus the spring series, of course, that Chelsea won. I think Chelsea, especially with the additions that they've made, they look good.
Oh, they look phenomenal. I mean, well, you have Marin Mielda scoring a pair of goals, Drew Spence getting one early, Fran Kirby also getting one. I mean, that's six in the opener, and we thought that Bristol City, you know, it is an interesting off season for them, to say the least. But when you you know, kind of preview them, you're saying that they might be that team in that third tier that could be punching up or punching above their weight a little bit and making some things happen this year. And man, that must have been an absolute smack in the jaw right there, because you go on the road, sure, it's Chelsea in the opener, a team that's looking to hit the ground running, especially in a new stadium as well. That's important, by the way, to remember. You know, that's a fresh audience to an extent, and you want to give them something to remember in the open. And scoring six, that's going to draw a fair few more people to the King's Meadow. And yeah, that's a tough one for Bristol City right there. I mean, you kind of feel bad for Sophie Bagley in goal, because you don't want to be picking up the ball out of your own net more times than you save it. But saving six, and she got peppered with a lot more, that's a tough one. But yeah, Chelsea look good. They look really good. And that's a deep bench as well. You think about Millie Bright didn't even play in that one. And she probably would have been the best, or might have been one of the best defenders in the Euros. That's scary.
Yeah, Millie Bright didn't play, and Iluko came off the bench. They've got serious depth there. I think that was the key. You know, they didn't overhaul the team. They made a couple of very, very good additions. But what they did was, other than Niamh Fahey, who's gone to Bordeaux, they managed to keep hold of pretty much the entire squad from the spring series. So I think they are the team to beat. They look excellent at the moment. But credit to Man City, 4-0 away at Yeovil. They will be pushing, of course they will, but I just think that Chelsea have probably got the upper hand. And Arsenal, obviously, I'm not quite sure what the thinking is with Pedro Lopes' setup. As I said, I didn't see the game, I just saw the goals, and it looked like he went with a couple of midfielders in defence again. Obviously, Josie Henning has returned, but one of the concerns that I had at the start of the season was that they might be a little bit light at centre-back. They conceded twice to Birmingham, who are a very good side, but those problems might cause issues later on in the season, perhaps.
Yeah, it would. But yeah, you know, you got to give Birmingham a lot of credit there. That ball that Adrina Hagenberg played to Ellen White for the first goal, class. That was a beautiful ball to split the center backs. Ellen White, of course, you're going to go with her 10 out of 10 to finish from that range. And yeah, you know, that That's a tough one for Arsenal, and especially what they lost Quinn there 10 minutes from time. And also they needed a pair of goals late on just to get that result. You have to give them a little bit of credit for fighting the way that they did for Arsenal. You know, it's never easy to go down a player late and still be trailing by a goal to a team that, not to say on paper you're supposed to beat, but you should be beating Birmingham at home. You have to give them a lot of credit. And of course, when you have Jodie Taylor being Jodie Taylor of the last few months, everything that she touches goes into the back of the net. So, yeah, good on them. I don't think, though, that that result's going to shadow Birmingham for too long. I think that they're, you know, by that, my always harp with them is where are the goals that are going to come from. Sure, Ellen White got a pair, but if you have the ball being moved like it was in that match, or at least what I saw from that match, because didn't have access over here in the States for that one, but the team was knocking the ball around the pitch well. If they can continue to do that, they're going to be set up for a pretty decent year.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think both teams will be in for a decent year. Arsenal, obviously, a lot more expectation on Arsenal, but I like Birmingham. I think you're right. They showed in the spring series they're a good team. They got to the FA Cup final. They are, as we would say over here, they are no mugs, and I think they will certainly impress over the course of the season. I mean, we kind of glossed over Everton Liverpool a bit. I apologise for any listeners who would follow the Reds or the Blues of Merseyside, but I mean, that's another interesting one, isn't it? Obviously, Liverpool, I see in that second bracket, maybe just below that top three, but you know, good start for them, because Everton have recruited well, and obviously we know Andy Spence well on this show. He's been on as a guest presenter in the past, and you know, I bumped into Andy when Everton had a friendly down here at Arsenal, and he said, "You know what, Kieran?" He said, "Don't write us off. You know, we're a good side, and we'll hopefully, you know, prove a few people wrong, but you want to try and get something against your rivals, don't you? So to lose to Liverpool, that's a blow for them, isn't it?"
Yeah, well, what I'm understanding here is that if it wasn't for their new goalie for Everton, Lizzie Dirac, it could have been 4-5-0 to Liverpool. And then Charles got a pair of goals. She got one, and Tash Harden got one. So, yeah, not ideal for them to start off for Everton, giving up a pair on the opening match. But yeah, I think it's going to be interesting, because when you talk about with Everton not giving up on them right now, I wasn't really even considering them that they would have, you know, any proximity to the drop zone. I thought that they were going to be a solid, you know, middle of the table respectability, nick a few wins against some teams that they might not be able to, or people might not think that they would. But yeah, I picked them probably for six. I think six would have been, you know, rather respectable. They're going to be torn at times, especially like you said, with depths, you know, the depth in the squad of Chelsea, Man City, and Arsenal. They're going to have difficulty on some days, but yeah, I won't bury them on this one, but they're going to need to shore up their defense, because again, what I'm reading is that it was pretty one-way traffic for 90 minutes. So that's not a good start. But elsewhere, I don't think that they're going to have a lot of issues.
No, I think you're right. I think they'll be okay. Made a good deadline day signing of Courtney Sweetman-Kirk from Doncaster Rovers Bells, and they've got Chloe Kelly on loan from Arsenal. So plenty of firepower going forward. I spoke to Danielle Turner, their new captain. Obviously, Michelle Hinnegan has left the club. So Danielle Turner is the new captain, and she was confident they'll do well. You know, they've recruited, but you could say that about almost all the teams, couldn't you? Recruited well, expected to do okay, but obviously someone has to finish, you know, in the bottom few positions. I've no idea how it's going to go, but it's only week one, so it's very early to kind of start making predictions. But usual suspects doing well on the opening weekend, and a couple of surprise results as well. So yeah, we'll have to see how that pans out over the coming weeks and the coming months. We'll have a quick break, and then JJ, we've got some more management talk to cover off as well. So yeah, a couple of managerial, well, one managerial departure, one managerial arrival. So we'll cover that off in a second.
Women's Soccer Zone would like to thank our partners, She Kicks Magazine. Subscribe at shekicks.net for even more women's football.
So JJ, Mark Sampson wasn't the only national team coach who lost their job in the last week or so. Emily Lima, the national team coach for Brazil, was fired from her position in the last few days after what can only be described as a poor run of results for the Brazilian team. Obviously, you had the opportunity, well, we both did, had the opportunity to see them play in the Tournament of Nations. Obviously, it didn't quite go according to plan there. Very heavy defeat against Australia. Looked like they might get a win over the United States and threw that away in the last few minutes. And I think they got a draw against Japan as well. They've just had a double header against the Australians down under and they lost both of those games. But we were looking at Emily Lima's record before the recent kind of dip in form. They were 7 wins in a row. You know, they had a really good start under her tenure. And now she's out of a job after a few bad results. Lasted less than a year. I mean, harsh, I think, is the word to use.
I think it's very harsh. I mean, you look at it right now, and I'm trying to dig up quickly, you know, what the record was for Vidal. He was given 3 years to kind of try and figure it out. Emily Lima, they gave her, what, 9 months, 10 months at the job? I mean, that's brutal. I mean, that's not enough time to really do anything for that matter outside of assess what your roster is. There's no competitive matches right now. I know that we're gaining closer and closer to World Cup qualifiers, but I mean, we can't guarantee, but let's just face the facts here. Brazil should have little issue getting through to the Women's World Cup through qualifying. So give her an opportunity to at least try and qualify, and then if you see some issues afterwards, if the team struggles but gets through okay, then you look elsewhere. But man, I mean, that's harsh. I mean, let's put it this way, Vidal wasn't brilliant, but at least, you know, he got the team to competitive stage. I mean, sure, probably should have done a little better in the Olympics. Let's be fair here. I mean, that's a home one, or a home tournament for them, and a lot of people were pegging them to not only medal, but to potentially win the gold. And, you know, he doesn't do it. Okay, so you give Emily Lima an opportunity. You know, what she was trying to do was bring in some player, you know, some younger players that might have not gotten a whole lot of experience under Vidal and under previous coaches. I'm looking at the roster, Kieran, that she brought in for the matches against Australia. I'm seeing a lot of players aged 22, 23, 24 that didn't get a whole lot of opportunities. So let your team experiment a little bit, because you always know you're going to have Marta available. You're always going to have Cristiane available. You know, Andressinha has now become really this, not to say new phenomenon, we've known about her, especially here in the States, for a while, but she's a player that's really starting to make her mark on Brazilian soccer. But give her a year at least, not under 10 months. I mean, that's brutal.
Yeah, you have to look at these as projects, don't you? You know, this isn't club football like the Premier League, where if you have a few bad results, you know, you're playing catch up and there's chance of relegation. You have to give national team coaches an opportunity to stamp their mark, to play the way that they want to play, to get the players in that they want, you know, develop younger players. You know, it's not easy. It's really, really difficult when you're a new coach. And it's actually really interesting, and I have to credit Jen Gordon who tweeted it out, and she's absolutely right. During the NSCAA convention in Los Angeles earlier this year, Emma Hayes was a guest speaker at one of the seminars, and she actually said something along the lines of, you know, if you're a woman, if you're a head coach and you're a woman, you are given less time to prove yourself than if you're a male coach. It's almost as though if you're a male coach, you have a few bad results, you're given that time to try and make things right. And if you're a female coach, you get a few bad results, all of a sudden you are under pressure. And I think that's a fair comment. You know, Emily Lima, as we said, started off really well. Her record actually shows more wins than defeats over her time as the national team coach. And you look at the teams that she's lost to. We're talking about Australia, probably the most informed team in 2017, along with the Netherlands. We're looking at the USA, who were the home side in the Tournament of Nations. We're looking at Japan, who, you know, that was a draw, and Japan are going through a very similar phase to Brazil at the moment, where they've got a little bit of a, you know, a turnover of players, and they're going for a bit of a transition. They lost to Germany, I think it was, in July. You know, they're not losing to bad teams. They're losing to teams who are in the top 10, top 5 teams in the world. You know, this is not, losing to minor nations, they needed to give her more time.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm looking at their schedule right now. They're set to play in a tournament in China against Mexico, the host nation, and Korea, DPR. I think after that point, that's when you can assess, right? You know, you've given her a full year, plus played in the annual Manaus tournament that's Brazil's hosted over the past couple of years. They got wins against Costa Rica, which is, we know, they're a team that's very much on the rise. Italy, on their day, they could show some good class. Beat Russia. How about this, by the way? Earlier on this year, they went to Iceland, beat Iceland. They went to Spain, beat Spain. So it's not like, okay, so their wins are coming against, we like to call them here cupcakes in the U.S. Opponents just to try and get yourself a little bit of confidence. Yeah, those are decent teams that they're beating, and the losses are coming against all top 10 nations of the world. So, yeah, I think the Brazilian Federation, they're just looking for a reason. They did what they did. So here we go again with, I believe, it's Vidal that's going to come back into the role, and they think that all of a sudden he's just going to right the ship. I think they've rushed this one a lot.
Yeah, totally agree. Really, really sad for Emily Lima. I think she deserved more time, and yeah, I think this is a knee-jerk reaction by the Brazilian Federation, and it's a massive shame, massive shame. But we said there's one departure of a female coach. There's one addition of a female coach, because Corinne Diacre, the former coach of a men's side in French football, Clermont Foot, has replaced Olivier Echouefny as the head coach of the French national team. Now, I think this might have happened, JJ, before our last show, but we couldn't quite squeeze it in. But she's now had two fixtures already under her belt. They got a 1-0 win over Chile. They got a 3-1 win over Spain. Now, Corinne is a French national team legend. She had over 100 caps for the country. She's very well known in French women's football. Off the back of someone who was the complete opposite, Olivier Echouefny, no record in women's football whatsoever. I think this has gone down quite well in France. I've spoken to a few people, and we've got a piece going up on the website about Corinne's appointment this week. I like that appointment, and I think we might see the French kick on a little bit, and potentially they might now have the right person in charge.
Yeah, this comes as a difficult time right now for the program, because this enters in that next phase, and I talked about this before with the Netherlands, and not to say that they proved me wrong, but in the sense that they didn't have many competitive matches going into hosting the Euros, because you already qualify as the host. So how is the team going to respond against programs that have been playing, tough qualifiers game? To same thing coming here for France to an extent, because they're going to pretty much be sitting all of next year and half of the year after without playing a match that has any meaning. Sure, you can schedule top class friendlies, no doubt. They're going to be playing in the She Believes Cup coming next spring, so they're going to get good matches there. They'll schedule some top quality friendlies, but those are friendlies. They're not competitive matches. So you have to kind of wipe the board a little, or wipe the slate clean a little bit. Like going off the back, what you're saying, this is a good appointment for them. But this should be the coach that's going to take them to the World Cup. There should be no, second thoughts, kind of going with what we just chatted with Brazil a few moments ago. Should be no second thoughts. This is the person that they want. This is the person that they need to get the job done. So let her do the job and give her the full backing. And, this team right now with France, they're coming off of a very disappointing major tournament yet again. How do they respond, especially knowing that there's going to be a lot more pressure at stake coming a couple of summers from now?
Yeah, without question. And I think that's why they've done it now. I think you're right. This is the coach that will lead them into the 2019 World Cup on their home turf. They have originally backed Olivier Echouefny. I think, I do have some feelings for him. I have some, some sympathies, because the French Football Federation came out and they backed Echouefny after the elimination from the Euros, and then within a few weeks they've sacked him and replaced him. So I don't necessarily agree with that, but the timing of getting Diacre in is absolutely spot on for me. They've got her in as early as possible, ahead of the next couple of years before the World Cup happens. All kicks off on the 7th of June in Paris. That was confirmed last week, and the final will be on the 7th of July in Lyon. You know, she's now got almost 2 years to get that team and mould that team how she wants it to. And you know, we've seen with Holland, no competitive football in the lead up to Euro 2017 on their home turf. They go and win the whole competition. So perhaps this could be France's year. And we already saw in the two friendlies, you know, she brought in players from different clubs, brought in some young players, you know, obviously lost the likes of Camille Abeli, who has, you know, retired from international football since the Euros. So I think it's going to be an interesting time for the French national team. Obviously, she was already in the system beforehand. Before going to Clermont Foot, she was the head coach of Soyeur, and she was the assistant coach for the French team for a few years as well. So she will know a lot of those players. She knows the setup, knows the system, and I think that was a very, very smart appointment by the French team. Before we move on, JJ, I do want to talk about one of the goals that was scored in the Spain game. I think it was the Spain game, where Laura George scored from a set piece where you saw... Now, you guys, I think, call it ring around the rosy. Over here, we call it ring a ring of roses, where a few of the French players on the edge of the box all linked arms or linked hands and almost like went round in a circle. And as the corner was about to be taken, all broke away in different directions into the box. The ball has gone to the back post to Amandine Henry, and she's played it back into Laura George. I have never seen that before, but it worked, and it was both hilarious and incredibly clever as well.
Well, I think that's the mark in it. If you do something like that, if you score, you look like an absolute genius, whoever was the one that actually diagrammed that up. I mean, I bet the players took a lot of fun in actually, you know, training that routine. And, you know, sometimes it's the thing that you need, Kieran, as a coach. Just put a little fun in there. You know, these are players in the national team. They get together, what, maybe a dozen times a year? You know, they're already, not to say tired from their club, you know, day in, day out training, but, you know, these are extra matches that you go on. And for France, again, like I said, they're not going to be playing a competitive match for a while. Have a little fun with it. And I love that. I mean, as a defender, who the heck are you going to be marking, and where are they going to be coming from? Because they're in like a small little circle, what, the top of the D or thereabout? And yeah, who knows where they're going to be peeling off of? So yeah, tactical genius. Hilarity level very high, but if it also didn't work, we would just be only talking about it as how funny it was and why did they bother going through that. But hey, you know what? That's why you attempt it in matches like that, see if it works, and maybe we might see that coming down the road again. I mean, we've seen it with players doing rock, paper, scissors to take free kicks. Well, you know what? Maybe run around in circles off corner kicks might be the new trend.
I'd love it if it took off and it was the French women's national team which were the leaders in trying to make it happen. Maybe they saw it somewhere else. I've never seen it, but it may well be that it's happened somewhere else. If anyone has seen it elsewhere, do obviously link us on Twitter. That would be great. I think we'll round it up, JJ. We've got one more thing that we want to talk about in this part of the episode. Obviously, as we said at the beginning of the show, we're going to release a second part because there has been so much going on in women's football. Keeping in kind of the theme of international football, Argentina, a team that we haven't seen or heard a lot from over the last few years. The last major tournament they qualified for, off the top of my head, I think, was the World Cup in 2007. They took a bit of a beating in that tournament, if we're being brutally honest. There was some news that broke over the weekend, and as I said, I was a little bit out of the loop over the weekend because I was at a wedding, but you can fill people in because you caught the news of what's going on there.
Yeah, so pretty much the team has gone, at least what my understanding is, they're on strike or they're currently having discussions with the Argentinian Football Association. Just, again, more poor standards that the team is being lived to. This is partly from Excel Sports, partly from our friends over at Equalizer, amongst others, about low pay for the players. They're being paid low as $8.50, roughly, per training session. Additionally, for a match that they played right at the back end of August against Uruguay, didn't have a hotel that was provided for them. They traveled on game day to Uruguay from Argentina, then played the match, then bussed after back home, amongst a few other things. I mean, mate, I did that for high school soccer here in the U.S., where we would take a bus to, you know, whatever local school that we're playing. A trip, I think the longest trip that we had to take was, you know, a couple hours for a state tournament. And I know that some colleges at the lower levels, if it's a school that's only within an hour or hour and a half away, you'll bus down on the same day. We're talking about a national team that's traveling on the same day on a bus, not a charter plane, which, I mean, you know, still that's a challenge, but at least, you know, you have control of what's happening. You're going on a bus over, you know, South America, so you're having some mountains in there, and then playing a match, and then come back home on the same day. That's brutal, and that's just unfair. And, you know, this is going on all of what we've seen over the past, 18 months, the U.S. having issues, Australia having their own CBA talks, Ireland, where we found out that they were trading kits with the boys' youth national teams and having to change in airports onto their with their Ireland gear. Denmark most recently, Nigeria having problems. I mean, it just continues to go on and on. The one part of me is disgusted in all this, but the one part of me is also happy to say that the players, that they're putting this now, you know, in their own hands and making a statement by saying, treat us the way that you treat the men's side, or we just won't play. And we saw with Denmark, they came to an agreement to play the World Cup qualifier. Hopefully now with Argentina, we get the same thing here.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Denmark situation maybe more in our next episode or the second part of this podcast. But you're absolutely spot on. $8.50 for a training session. Pardon my language, but you are taking the piss. Like, that is not even worth getting out of bed for. These are athletes who look after themselves, who are representing their country, who are pulling on their national jersey, and you're going to give them $8.50 for turning up for a training session? That is not even worth it. And to
on
travel
a cow patch, by the way, on horrible facilities.
Yeah,
we have to forget that. We can't forget that as well.
That is a joke. That is an absolute joke. And you know, you look at, they're not even ranked at the moment, Argentina. You know, you look at the FIFA World Rankings, they have two stars next to their name, and those two stars are not the indicator of a team that's won two World Cups. That is a team that has been inactive for more than 18 months and is therefore not ranked. You know, that is ridiculous. You know, a major nation in the men's game, and they can't even get their women's team active for a friendly or for any competitive football. You know, it's you're right. You know, players are now, and I wrote the piece about it last week or the week before, why are players now having to put themselves in a position where they risk their careers to save them, their international careers? You know, it's ridiculous. You look at, I mean, looking at the FIFA World Rankings, listed below Argentina are Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea dropped 70 places in the FIFA World Rankings that were released recently because they've been inactive for 18 months as well. So they drop out of the top 118 nations because they've been inactive for a year and a half. It's like, what are these federations doing? Like, why is it that these teams are not playing? It just makes no sense to me whatsoever. I mean, Argentina, we're talking about a team that was, as I said, the World Cup 10 years ago. So
yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely, the players are doing the right thing. And it's just so frustrating, isn't it, when you read stuff like this? And I hate to end this part of the show on a negative, but, you know, it is difficult, isn't it? You know, you wanna highlight these issues. You don't want to drag things through the mud, but you know, we see the qualities of an Estefani Bernini on a weekly basis in the NWSL. What odds there are more Estefani Berninis in Argentina, but they're not given the opportunity to play at the highest level because they're not being given the opportunities?
Well, mate, I mean, I'm cycling through this list right now, the one that you're saying with the rankings. I mean, let's read off actually some names of teams that were, you know, doing some good things very recently, or at least, you know, you expect them to be competitive because of where their men's program is. Paraguay, they haven't played a match in close to 2 years. Ecuador, remind me, Kieran, were they last World Cup?
They were, yeah. They were in England's. They're in England's group.
That's a team that hasn't played in 2 years. Haiti hasn't played in 2 years. Uruguay, Panama, Jamaica, they were knocking on the doorstep of potentially qualifying for the World Cup. Guatemala, like, these are teams, mate, that, like, what's going on? Like, why can't, you know, I understand for, like, some parts of the region, okay, you know, Asia-Pacific, you might not have many opportunities outside of those World Cup qualifiers, and maybe that's one of the reasons why New Zealand continues just to run roughshod right through that region. But you have a lot of Caribbean nations, and there's competitions that happen there. There's African nations that haven't played in years. I mean, there's a team. There's teams that, like, you might even have to wonder, have they played in the last 10 years? I mean, we don't know. Like, this is crazy, whereas on the men's side, you're still going to have team ranked number 209 or whatever, but they've probably played a match in the last 3 months. So, yeah, it's confusing.
It's crazy. I will end it on a lighter note. I'm half Sri Lankan. People might not know about that, but my father is from Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka are ranked 107th in the world. That means they have been active. They actually have a ranking. They moved up 4 places in the last FIFA World Rankings. We're a nation famous for cricket, mate, not for football, I can tell you that. So the fact that Sri Lanka are ranked above the likes of Argentina and Ecuador, who've played in World Cups, that tells you how mental it is. It's completely bizarre. And another nation win in dispute with their federation, having to go on strike to try and get things going and make things happen. But there you go. Sorry to end on a bit of a sour note. The next episode, or the second part of the podcast that we will release, has some positive stuff as well. And it hasn't been all down on this episode. As I said, we had to talk about some difficult things. There are positives that come out of those difficult things. Of course there are. And obviously we'll keep tabs on those and see how things work out. As I said, this is episode 54.1. We will release 54.2 as well. That will have some different talking points. Of course, if you want to follow us on social media, you can do. We're on Twitter, on @WosoZone. To listen to the show, you can do so on Audio Boom, or you can listen to us on the website, womenssoccerzone.com. Email us with any comments, if you like, on wosozone@gmail.com. And, we will have a second part to this podcast. So, JJ, thanks very much for your help on this part.
Yes, absolutely.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We will speak to you very soon. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.